And to begin, a Latter-day Rhapsode brings the rhythms of Homer to the plains of Abraham.
And then in silence, red-haired wolf knelt home again and answered thus, "My friends, I thank you for your words. I do not thank you for your thoughts. I never shall renounce my vow to seize impregnable Quebec."
Early evening, middle of the week, corner of Main and Hastings, Vancouver's vibrant, dangerous downtown east side. Outside the venerable Carnegie Center, a man strolls up and down amongst the milling throng. He calls out, "Crack for sale, crack for sale." And inside, by way of contrast, is Jack Mitchell reciting his epic poem about the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. Jack Mitchell is a Canadian graduate student, 28 years old. He's at Stanford University, where he's polishing off a PhD in classics. He's, of course, spent a lot of time with Homer, and he wants to infuse Canadian history with the stuff of the great Greek bard, hence his epic poem, and hence his mission, which is to travel across the country, moving from the west to the east, reciting the thing. I've met Jack Mitchell before. I was happy to meet him again. He is an altogether amazing young man.
"And there you may fulfill your vow to seize the impregnable Quebec."
The Border Customs agent, when we crossed in from Washington State, we drove up from California, definitely couldn't quite believe what our plans were, and we managed to convince them, as I've convinced many a border agent in my time.
Did you actually recite a bit of the poem?
No, I was busy trying to look extremely professional. And,
how does an epic poet, a performing epic poet, what's more, look professional?
Well, no listener will be able to see what I'm wearing, but I've taken to wearing a sort of performative garb of somewhat flashier black shirt than I would ever wear, let me tell you, in normal life, and that's about the extent that I have. I mean, if called upon, I could have opened up the trunk and shown her my performative staff, which would have raised even more eyebrows, I'm sure. I bought it on eBay. It began life as a martial arts staff.
Oh, really?
I had to saw it down a little bit because it was looking a little too violent.
We'll come back to the performative staff, but let's talk first of all about the poem itself. Why did you decide to revisit it at this time?
Well, I've been off in California studying Homeric poetry the whole time, and the thing that had always sat in the back of my mind was, here I am, a Canadian epic poet in California studying Homer. When am I going to get back on the road? And I'd made some advances in my technique, I believe, and I really, having tested it out 5 years ago, I now want to take it to the Canadian people once again and really get their feedback.
You're studying classics and had them for some time. You're at the PhD level now. How does your poem connect to Homeric ode or to other kinds of epic poems, Vedic poems, for instance?
I've drawn inspiration particularly on the metrical side from the Vedic and the Sanskrit epics, not so much on the level of content, because they're much vaster and more, epic in scope than some of the Greek stuff. The great parallel for me is between the Siege of Troy and the Siege of Quebec, and in terms of narrative, in terms of characterization, in terms of both the protagonists dying, you got Achilles and Hector before Troy, you got Wolf Montcalm before Quebec. It's been on the level of content, it's been on the level of meter. Most of all, it's been on the level of what the poems of Homer did for Greece in terms of unifying all these different traditions. And what I'd like to do is to try and create a small nucleus around which potentially Canadian epic poetry, if it takes off from here, could build. And I think the 18th century is a really good spot for that.
Let's hear a little bit of your poem then. Just start it out.
"The double death in warlike strife of red-haired wolf and dark Montcalm. That is the tale, immortal angel, dwelling in the winter sky, how once upon a time they fought before impregnable Quebec, amid the bitter musket smoke upon the plains of Abraham, and both were robbed of life by heaven's power and hurled beneath the earth, where in the darkness rest the dead, unmindful of the mortal day." That's the first bit, and then from there I go on to a sort of recap of the situation during the siege, and from there actually start into the narrative. And actually, one of the big changes that I've made is in the tone of voice that I use. I'd always, before, used the type of voice that you just heard, but for the narrative now, I've started using more of a slightly more musical type of intonation. So, let's say, But tell me this, immortal angel, dwelling in the winter sky, which of the English brigadiers was first to go to General Wolfe upon that 12th day of September, shivering in the early morn? Not one was first. They came together, gathering in the army's camp, and they were three, etc., etc. So it's slightly more trance-like. My attempt is to now to sort of induce the audience into a bit of a sort of sleepwalking mode so that they can endure longer and longer chunks of epic poetry. And I think that has worked.
See, I love this because on the surface of it, it sounds, well, let's just say it out loud, loony Canadian epic poet, Plains of Abraham, you know? I mean, there's a quixotic quality about the whole thing, a whimsical quality. But you're very serious about this.
Well, I fundamentally am. I mean, I have to be a little bit abashed when talking to total strangers, and they definitely, the word exotic does get thrown around a lot, at least probably not in my presence, but I'm sure it's lurking at the back of most people's minds. For me, though, it's a very serious endeavor. I mean, I want to make not only Canadian epic a viable enterprise, but also to make performative epic come alive again in English after basically 800 years of not having it. And I think
who was the last in English?
Well, it's sort of when we lost the alliterative stuff, we sort of lost the tradition of the bard wandering around. Mm. So when by the time of Chaucer, people are composing with pens, and as soon as you get writing as the main medium of composition, suddenly it's not quite the spontaneous oral tradition which really did exist in English, especially before the Norman conquest.
Let's hear a little bit of Homer and then a little bit of Mitchell.
Okay, let's see, what about the classic, can you handle the opening of the Iliad?
Oh, of course.
Oh, it's I mean, it doesn't get much more classic than this. Menina edetea, beleia diawachileios, ula menen chemuria chaios algeeteke, polas diptimus psuchasa idi proiapsen, cheroon autuste chaloria tiucha ktunesin, oio noisi te pasi, dioste beleia tobuloi. So that's the first opening of the Iliad, and it's if there's one thing that the Greek school children in 500 BC were memorizing those lines, and I'm still memorizing them. So that's the style of Homeric poetry, and you can kind of hear how there's a consistent rhythm to it, even with a degree of variety.
Okay, so now something else from your epic.
Oh, let's see, how about but now the boats approached the shore, and all the soldiers disembarked. Some few brave men went on ahead and slew the sentries as they slept, the sentries who held quiet watch upon that steep and dreadful cliff, and all the soldiers followed after, climbing up that steep-faced cliff. So then indeed the red-haired wolf gave word unto the English troops, the English troops, the soldiers clad in red, were climbing all night long, beneath that banished moon, until they reached the plains which lay above.
Hmm. It's so interesting that you've become this kind of person who venerates the past and holds it dear in the present and makes it part of the present, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like you're a link somehow.
Oh, that's in so many words the mission I aspire to. I can't say I've succeeded yet, but I definitely want to put my life on the line for that. I think the past is essential for the future. I think if we want to be remembered, we have to do the remembering of people first. And there's a reciprocity between ourselves and the past, which it would be a great mistake to cut off. I mean, I realize we're in a period in which everything is flowing more and more rapidly towards what we call the future, but it seems that future is always more and more of a present. And I'd like to think that we are sort of rich enough and mature enough after the shocks of the Industrial Revolution and the mass production which has so improved the modern world, that this degree of prosperity has allowed us the opportunity to take a step back at least once now in a while and sort of survey where we've come from and look to where we might go.
Mm. What are you most looking forward to?
I'm most of all looking forward to the unknown, I think.
How do you say that in Greek?
Menoto agnoston. I await the unknown.
Jack Mitchell. On the lookout for the unknown while traveling across Canada, www.jackmitchell.ca. Coming up on Bunny Watson, more tales of the road from folk singer Jeremy Fisher.